Welcome to the Sandman Salon.
Huzzah.
Another episode.
Hi, Amber. How's it going?
Hello from New York.
Yay. How is New York?
Dirty. Oh. Loud. Oh, huh. It was humid and then rainy.
Well, I know you were there to experience the weather. But what else were you doing in New York?
Well, it's funny because there was a comic book convention.
What?
Called New York Comic Con. I got over there for exactly 2 hours for the entire time.
Oh, wow. How come? Like, I mean, I guess you were doing your actual job and being busy with that stuff.
Yeah, I was doing my actual job, and it was a series of very civilized meetings over in the hotel lounge area. And then yesterday I got sick. So
oh, no.
I was in bed. Yeah.
Oh.
I'm a little snuffly.
That sucks. I'm sorry. Being sick at a con is the worst.
It's better to be sick in the United States. Like, not because it's any better here, but because it's less foreign. It's always really scary to be sick while you're traveling.
Because they, like, try to give you, like, old folk remedies and, like, worms and stuff. You're like, I have a headache. Like, have this ox blood. Is that what it's like outside the United States, Amber?
No, it's just a matter of, like, comfort and, like, you know, I know how to dial 911 or, you know, like, things like that. Like, the practical, like, if things go wrong.
Got it.
And usually in the places where I'm traveling, I know people. So, like, if I need help, then I can call somebody. And just the other way, you're just alone. You're just on your own.
I'm sorry. That sounds sad, to be alone and sick in a foreign place. But
yeah, so on that uplifting note.
Well, what did you get to see in the brief time that you were at New York Comic Con? Anything fun?
The one thing I went to go see was the Image Comics horror panel. We Believe in Horror. So I got to hear a bunch of creators talking about their books, like Bitterroot and Infidel and Ice Cream Man and a couple more. And so it was just good just hearing them talk about their books, and I always love hearing creators talk about, like, their process or what they're thinking as they're creating these things.
Neat.
Yeah.
Any Sandman appearances or anything in the realm of the dreaming spotted?
So, yes, actually, I did meet John Jennings, who is an academic and kind of just an all-around badass when it comes to comics and African-American comics in particular, the intersection and representation and creative talent. He teaches at UC Riverside along with Nalo Hawkinson, and he was the character designer for Uncle Monday.
That's awesome. How did he come about doing that? Or
they teach together, and they're both sort of in the Afrofuturism world. And so I think that's how he got involved, but he definitely wants to talk to us.
Nice. Well, we'll talk to him.
He's down for an interview.
Yeah, cool. Uncle Monday is pretty rad looking. I'll have to go and look at his design a little bit more to think about how it was a whole different person creating that character.
In comics creation, you can have people do the design and then other people bring it to life. And that's what a lot of comics creators do when they're doing superhero stuff. They're taking, you know, at least something iconographic and making it move.
Yeah, stuff that creators might have designed ages ago. And a new artist will pick it up and dust it off or rethink it a bit.
Right. Like, you know, like what? Like the Sandman.
That's true.
That happened.
That is exactly true. Neil Gaiman's Sandman is so different from the classic Sandman.
The 1960s Sandman.
Yeah, I wonder if when Neil was like, so I'm going to reimagine a character for you, they were probably like, oh, nice. Maybe he'll have a different outfit. And, I wonder if they anticipated the degree of change that the Sandman was about to have. You know, how completely different.
Because I remember reading something. I remember reading an interview, I think, with Neil Gaiman, where he said that when he was talking with Karen Berger about doing it, she said, I think he pitched it to her. If I remember right, she said, okay, you can do it, but it has to be completely different than the one before. That was kind of his marching orders.
Yeah, well, there you go. He did that pretty well, I'd say.
I would say so.
So here we are back in the dreaming once again.
I am so daunted at the prospect of having to talk about this in any kind of reasonable length of time.
This week.
Because I have, no joke, like 20 pages of notes.
Oh, shit.
And I didn't even get through the entire issue.
Oh, wow. Well, we can take a stab at it.
A lot of it was like the background research, the encyclopedia reference desk kind of stuff that you get into with any Sandman story. So a lot of this I'm just going to post on Facebook.
Nice. Cool.
Because there's no way. Yeah. There's no way we can get into all of this.
Yeah. It's funny. I did a couple of Wikipedia trips and looked a few things up, but I mostly spent the issue kind of feeling like the emotional, like, pinball machine of what we're experiencing in this comic and how it feels very real at the same time, and how it's really timely and feels very grounded in a neat way that I wasn't expecting. I mean, we'd gotten some whiffs of the kind of political undertones of this story in the first issue.
Yeah,
you know, we got the telegraph messages about immigration and change and all the things like that. The Merv Pumpkinhead perspective really fleshed out the issues
felt
that were
familiar.
Going on. Yeah, I thought it was very smart.
His head is orange, after all.
Oh, shit. You're right. Oh. Oh, but it's not...
I think it's one of those just cosmic coincidences, but, you know.
Oh, he's naturally orange, though. It's not like he doesn't, like, bronze himself to, like, look orange. I think he's...
Orange is ruined forever now.
Oh, man. Orange is, like, my favorite color. I don't think of 45 as orange. He's kind of his own, like, weird... unnatural, you know,
like atomic,
yeah,
orange.
Like Lovecraftian unnatural color that just shouldn't really exist in our world.
So the very first thing is the cover, and I think we were talking about this is Jay Lee again with these amazing covers, with Merv on the cover at a diagonal holding the Sandman's helm, which, you know, we were just talking about that, about the original 1960 Sandman, and the interpretation of the gas mask from that Sandman into this is so interesting, because it's very organic now. There's something like sect-like about it.
Yeah, it's this creepy spine that's also a trunk coming from the face of an insect-like helmet. Yeah, it's such a surreal, strange creation. Like, I feel like it's almost more random than almost anything in Dream's presentation. You know, he'll wear like jewels and cloaks and has unruly hair and has all these stylistic elements that make sense for a broody, dark dream god person. But then he's got this helmet that's just like, I don't even, you know, it's almost more H.R. Giger-ish.
Well, I have no doubt that the design of it comes from some kind of symbology, like some kind of mythological reference.
Maybe.
I don't know what it is.
Well, let's homework that. We can look into that, into the design of Dream's helm and how that came about. Because I feel like it really is so random. Like, I feel like it's really cool and iconic. My theory is that Neil Gaiman just sort of doodled it and was like, that would look cool. You know, and he was right about it. Like, there's nothing that really looks like it, but it is such a strange, creepy design that sticks in your head.
I think that nothing in Sandman is random. Even like a throwaway reference has so many layers of meaning.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, it is packed with subtexted meaning. I also think that, like, because of the nature of dreams, things that are just kind of random and crazy and beautiful and strange might not really get explained too thoroughly. It's just part of the weird nature of this universe.
I have no doubt that Neil Gaiman has been asked about the helm. So
yeah, let's see if we can find it out.
I'm sure. Yeah, I'm confident in our research skills.
But meanwhile, we have a lot more to discuss. The comic opens with Merv Pumpkinhead talking to an unseen figure. And he's griping and he's talking about all the problems that he's having with the dreaming and everything's falling apart. And he's sort of imploring this person to help the realm. And poor Merv, his face is rotting.
Yeah.
Like, everything's falling apart. The dreaming's like really crumbling and stuff real bad. And, like, the fact that his face is rotten, and he says that it's never happened before, and he's got, like, flies come flying around his cheek, that, like, really got me. Like, there's something really visceral and super sad about that to me. Of all of Merv's obnoxiousness, like, I don't know, to have your face rotting and still being expected to keep it together and no one's helping you out.
Yeah, I'm a lot less sympathetic.
Yeah? I mean, I think that the things he does are not sympathetic. It fills out his motives really well.
Yeah, and we get some really great backstory about who he is and where he came from.
Yeah.
But I also think of the rot as like a symbol of his stance, of his worldview, and the fact that it's all kind of bubbling up now.
Yeah, it's hard to tell, like, is the rot coming from something that's happening inside him, or the realm reflecting in him?
Well, I thought that he did, actually. I mean...
Yeah, I don't... It doesn't really say when that symptom began. I think he just started off. I wonder if in... I don't have the previous issue in front of me. I wonder if there's, like, a hint of it or something like that before.
Yeah, because in this, as we go through it, he's already rotting.
I wonder if we look back in the previous issue, we could see, like, his cheek, like, has a mark on it or something.
Yeah.
But I certainly didn't notice anything. It sucks. I feel Merv more than I did before. For all of his problems, I feel like he just sort of is who he is. And, like, this stuff that's going on, it's affecting him in a way that no one is really seeing. And I think that that's, like, powerful. What he's doing and what he's becoming is just a symptom of, like, greater problems. And I think that's an interesting thing to highlight and to make sure that we know.
Mm-hmm.
He's asking for help. When he reaches out to this person holds a gun to his head to make him back off. It's like, oh, right. Shit. Yeah, so whatever this person is, they're not friendly.
It's a white dude with a gun.
Pretty hostile. Pretty worrisome. Merv mentions a dream concept called the Milam Cascade. And in the next page, we see one of them happening. A Milam Cascade is when a dreamer wakes up in dreams, like just having a lucid dream, and starts kind of taking over their reality within a dream. In that case, all sorts of crazy stuff starts manifesting out of the mind of the dreamer in the dreaming, and it's not supposed to be there. And so basically, Merv and his team of people have to kind of go on damage control in one way or another to both, like, contain the dreamer's craziness and then buffer the dreaming's reality around them in some way. It's a little unclear what that really means. It's a lot of, like, sparkles and green.
And it doesn't happen to everybody. Like, there are people who do lucid dream in the dreaming, but it's only when someone has an especially powerful mind. I mean, he calls it raw crazy, but the references, like the two examples that they talk about are junkies and Tibetan monks who have some kind of special, maybe some special openness to other realities.
Yeah, people who are having some kind of transcendent experience already, and they are bringing that into the dreaming, and it shakes up the reality of the dreaming. I think it's a really cool concept, and I kind of wonder, with the dreaming manifesting all this crazy stuff and crumbling and with a big crack and everything that's happening in the dreaming, I feel like this concept of a dreamer who's awake in the dreaming, their subconscious or their conscious mind is doing anything it wants without limits. I wonder if that's what's going on with the dreaming. Is there, like, a mind becoming conscious in the dreaming and bringing all sorts of outside ideas there that don't belong?
Huh.
I feel like this is a meaningful concept that's been dropped on us here that plays to the bigger story. Just putting that out there.
It's just so hard to know at this point. But I think you're right. The way that I don't think anything in the Sandman is on accident.
Yeah.
This is obviously something that's going to come into
play. Like, if a dreamer can manifest random stuff from their mind, all this random stuff that's manifesting that no one understands, is there, like, a greater mind that's waking up in the dreaming and having a lucid dream? Like, something bigger than the average dreamer?
Yeah. What happens when the lucid dreamers gain awareness inside the dream? In this case, the dreamer is able to physically manifest herself and grab Merv, but I wonder what else can happen.
Yeah, and this dreamer in particular is interesting too. It's a naked woman with writing all over her body. She seems dark-skinned, and she's wearing a cloak with a golden clasp and a giant jade green mask that comes and goes over her face.
Mm-hmm.
We don't know anything about this person, but they seem significant.
Well, we know that she's an overdose.
Do we? Oh, interesting.
Yeah. Dora says she's an overdose on some new designer shit.
Oh.
She said she chucked her engagement ring in the sea, then swallowed a dozen caps deliberate.
Right.
Yeah. So I don't think she actually looks like this in the real world.
No.
But this is her manifestation of her image.
Yeah. After taking all these pills.
Right. And so she says it's designers, which makes me think it's some kind of hallucinogen.
Yeah. I feel like there are a bunch of elements that have just been kind of dropped here that we'll probably see again as we hear more of the Sandman universe, like a designer drug that gives people insane transcendent dreams that affect the dreaming.
I don't even know. To go back a little bit, you know, Merv is conducting this film crew to, like, distract the dreamer that's gaining awareness.
Yeah.
And so leaves and he goes back to get some help from Lucien, and Lucien is trying to shove this bird thing back into the big black box,
yeah,
which turns out to be a cuckoo, which showed up in A Game of You, or the cuckoo was messing around in Holly's dream.
Interesting. Murph says it lays eggs in folks' dream.
Yep, which is what the actual bird does. It's called a brood parasite, and it is one of a few species of birds that puts their eggs in other birds' nests. So they'll hatch them.
Yeah, they're brilliant and terrifying.
They really are.
You know, they'll lay an egg that no bird parent will recognize as alien. And then that chick will hatch bigger and stronger and earlier than the other chicks and kill the other chicks and the parents.
It could. I'm not sure if that always happens, but that would...
It pretty much always happens with cuckoos, I think. It's kind of part of their deal.
Yeah.
They like roll the other chicks out of the nest or just like are so much bigger and more demanding of the parent birds that the other ones just croak and don't get any food. You don't know what the parents think. Are they like happy to have this big, awesome super bird as their child or are they in horror? I don't know. Birds are so strange.
Well, it's very on brand for the dreaming.
Yeah, it really is.
So Lucien is trying to stuff this bird back in the box. And the cuckoo's saying that it's just trying to give a warning.
Yeah.
That something's trying to come in.
Mm-hmm. And this bird is full of little child's faces. Like its feathers are sort of engulfing tons of children, it looks like. It's really bizarre and scary. So they're trying to warn Lucien, but it doesn't really seem to say anything that substantial about anything that we don't already know necessarily. At least I didn't get anything from it like that, but it was just
an alarm. Well, I mean, Lucien won't let it talk.
Yeah.
I mean, is literally just saying to shut up.
Yeah. Yeah,
I mean, right. And that's where I'm like, is it saying something that is important, but Lucien won't let it out, especially not in front of Merv? And there's this whole idea of, like, conserving resources.
Yeah.
And getting rid of stray dream entities that are taking up dream energy.
Yeah, which is kind of a new concept. The logic of it is interesting.
I mean, it's definitely like austerity measures, you know, like, but like also it makes me think, I'm like, what is the deal with Lucien? This feels not necessarily like a white hat kind of thing.
What do you mean?
I mean, like, I'm not sure if his motives are completely pure in some ways.
No, yeah. Lucien just seems so consumed with just trying to keep things not completely crumbling, that
right.
He is just reacting and not really thinking about stuff anymore.
Exactly. Which is dangerous for a person like him who is all about reason and considering and research.
He's stuffing this cuckoo back into the black box using a staff that has Morpheus's helm on the tip of it. And so like he's wielding considerable power now. You know, it's unclear like what Lucien's powers really are, but he's able to impersonate Dream and he's able to really seemingly do all this stuff in the realm. Like he's quite a powerful caretaker, but he's not thinking.
And that is a big reason why Merv is so pissed off, because he sees Lucien as taking control when he hasn't, not that he hasn't earned it, but like it's not his place.
He's not an elected official. After this terrifying scene where Lucien's stuffing the cuckoo into the black chest, he basically like kind of kicks Merv out, and then they have when things settle down, they have more of a conversation. But we get a little bit of a window into Merv's history and how he was created,
which is really tragic and beautiful.
Yeah, it's really sweet. Like it seems like he's just always sort of been like this mouthy pumpkin in a pumpkin patch.
Yep.
And then old Morpheus kind of lifted him up and gave him a body and made him into what he was. And it seems like he basically hasn't changed in 400 years.
So I looked up the whole feet of clay thing, which is, okay, this is super interesting. So it is a passage from the book of Daniel in the Bible.
Cool. Well, let's describe it first, Jeff. So Morpheus picks up this talking pumpkin head from the patch and brings it over to a scarecrow body that's standing by the side. And he says some beautiful words, and then as he constructs Merv and says, "You shall be my feet of clay." So what does that mean?
Well, the thing is, it's not super flattering. It's about balance, which is sort of what this whole thing, that's a big theme in this whole issue. But The colloquial interpretation of it is that it's a like some character flaw for someone who is otherwise like lofty or important. But it comes from the Book of Daniel, which I was like, oh my God, it's Daniel.
Yeah.
Like,
interesting.
That's crazy. Like, that's a crazy deep reference.
Yeah.
And it comes from an interpretation of the dream of Nebuchadnezzar by Daniel, who at this point in the Hebrew and Christian Bibles is a prophet. And so it's it's an interpretation of a dream, which is like, Jesus, this is so incredibly relevant.
Wow.
Where it's basically about, it just blew my mind when I read this whole thing. It is about the fact that if you don't build something like a kingdom on a strong foundation, however beautiful, you know, like gold, jeweled, whatever it is at the top, if it turns out that the feet are clay, the whole thing is going to topple over.
Oh, wow.
I know.
Huh.
It's just like, wow.
Wow. So you shall be my feet of clay suggests that Merv and his station is sort of an old structural flaw of the dreaming.
Yeah, a weak link.
That sucks. That really sucks.
And so basically, I mean, that's the thing is like Morpheus is saying all these beautiful words and everything, but he's basically saying like, you're my mistake. I'm a flawless being, and so I'm going to make you a mistake in that kind of way. For like, for however great I am, you're not great.
But at the same point, if we think about it in not quite that macro level about the kingdom, Merv is the one who kind of keeps things real. He cleans up the messes. He's the one who does the heavy lifting. And when he talks, Dream listens. Like, Dream, like, respects him and seems to, like, and values him in a way that without Merv being this kind of ground-level caretaker, Dream might not really have much of a connection to his realm. He might not have the same connection to his realm.
Do you mean Morpheus?
Morpheus slash Dream. I don't really know how Daniel thinks about Merv, but I guess I am thinking of Morpheus and his old self, who was kind of, you know, tended to be pretty aloof and disconnected from his subjects. That's a very special kind of status that Merv has that seems valuable to the king, even if it implies some sort of flaw.
Well, I think he sees it as an imperative. He says, you know, things need to be balanced. I mean, it kind of all comes back to like with Morpheus realizing, you know, I'm setting up the stage for my own destruction. This is how fate is. This is how the world is balanced. What he wants doesn't matter in the world. It's what has to be done.
What Morpheus wants.
I'm talking about like Morpheus.
Yeah. His statement when he creates Merv is that he wants, it's some kind of balance. The ethereal repercusses from the terrestrial. And he's also dressed in kind of Shakespearean garb when he says this. So it makes it even, and he holds up Merv's head sort of like Hamlet.
Like Yorick. Yeah.
A little bit.
Merv is so touched by this, but like it was just a duty. You know, it was like this is something that Morpheus had to do in order to fulfill the obligation of the universe. Mm. And so I saw it as really kind of sad.
Yeah.
But also that part that was really touching was when he said, you'll never know what it's like to be created completely intentionally by a perfect being.
Yeah.
You know.
I feel like Merv sees Dream with a lens of a religious convert, someone who sees the king as a perfect being, as a flawless god. And that sort of language is terrifying. Like when someone thinks of themselves that way, as an intentional creation of a perfect being, that's usually like the first step to fanaticism.
I think that's where he's going with this.
Yeah.
So I did some research and the divisions between the panels are called gutters. Mm-hmm. The gutters on the Morpheus Merv creation page are like the swirly black smoke kind of things that are very much a Morpheus thing. But the next page with the columns, it's basically showing a scene where Merv and Lucien are walking down a flight or flights of stairs, dragging the black box, the big black chest. It actually looks a lot like the Ark of the Covenant to me.
Yeah, yeah. I think it's called the Black Chest is the official name.
It's called the Black Chest.
The Black Chest.
It also looks like the Ark of the Covenant.
Yeah.
Which held the Ten Commandments.
Yep.
Allegedly.
Mm-hmm. I saw the movie.
You saw Raiders of the Lost Ark? Everybody saw that? Okay.
Totally. Yeah. I'm familiar.
But the thing about this page with the columns and them dragging, or Lucien dragging the black chest, is the columns in all these different angles form the gutters for the panels.
Yeah, it's
wonderful. Not only that, but it's like the coloring this, and like shout out to Matt Lopez for this. The way that it goes from this blue, dusky purple down into a orangey pink kind of thing, down into a like very light sage kind of green.
The color shift. Yeah.
Yeah, the color shift, like the ombre of it, that's how it directs the action and like to follow the action in the panels. Like, it's masterful.
Yeah, it's really beautiful. Yeah, as they're dragging the black chest down the stairs and through the castle, the panels are all, they're divided up by these columns. The columns go all over the place in different angles, and it's really dramatically composed. As they go from like the cold, kind of creepy upper levels of the castle through the lobby where they're like dusting and vacuuming, and then to the outside. Yeah, the compositions in this comic are just wonderful.
The color is so important to how this story is told.
Yeah, and it's very subtle. Still talking about Merv and the nature of Merv.
Merv is not great. Merv's kind of more than a jackass.
He's kind of a dick. Yeah. He's
a dick, and he's like racist. Like, he's got this special pejorative term for the blanks. He calls them soggies.
Yeah.
Just unnecessary pejorative.
Yeah. This issue is basically like a shitty day in the life of Merv Pumpkinhead. It sucks. He leaves the Dreaming Castle. Lucien kind of like brushes him off a little bit. He doesn't really give him any answers. Lucien talks about reincorporating old dreams into the Dreaming, austerity measures, essentially.
And
that doesn't sit well with Merv, but they don't really go into it. And Merv goes back out to the Dreaming, where they were engaged with the woman who's dreaming herself awake in the Dreaming with a giant jade mask. They're still sort of working on it. They're still constructing kind of a set around the Dreamer, but they seem to have it under control. So Merv goes back to his crew, and he sees Dora and her Ziggy blank mannequin dude stealing stuff from the crew, I guess.
So his crew is saying they're stealing food, but it's like, what's happening? Like, where's the food coming from?
I kind of feel like it's maybe just an art mix-up maybe or something, where like the script said food and they're just like, well, just fill up bags of stuff, because it's not like they're at a craft services table, but there's just like junk everywhere, and it's hard to tell why Dora is there really and what she's actually taking. You know, she's hard to understand. She's about to get away with one of her special doorways, and Merv has a giant wrecking ball come down on her. And it's just like, you're not getting away that easily.
And he has to call her a dumb broad, of course.
Yeah.
So he does that, you know, and immediately karma happens, where the lucid dreamer takes hold of him, and he seems to be sort of melding into her.
Yeah.
And this is like, so this is right here is a shout out to the letterer. The lettering, the stream of consciousness babble coming from the woman is bolded in some places and just all one big run-on sentence. But it's also created in a way to look like it's convex. It's got a three-dimensionality, like a balloon inflating. Seriously, shout out to the letter.
Yeah. Yeah, it's cool. And this dreamer is giving kind of another alarming message from beyond. Things are coming through, overflowing. We must build up our defenses for things that are at our door. That's kind of what everybody's saying.
And she makes references to military and battle preparation.
Yeah. Yeah. Barbicans and cataracts.
Yep.
And ways of describing military stuff that we don't really use anymore. So there's something back there that seems kind of ancient. And while she's saying this, The jade mask is dissolving a little bit, and the dreamer's face is popping through to say this warning.
Mm-hmm.
So it sort of implies that this dreamer is actually ancient and maybe part of some other larger power with the jade mask. I'm super curious about them. I think their design is really neat, and I think there's a lot more to this character, and I want to I'm very curious about them and want to find out more.
Mm-hmm.
And hope that they come back. Awesome design. And I wonder if they're like a character that we've actually met in the real world or will meet and won't know for a while that they're this dreamer too. The way that in the game Inverse, gods can just sort of look like anybody, and you won't really find out what their powers are until they choose to reveal them to you.
Yeah.
I like when that happens, so I'm looking forward to that happening with this character, hopefully. We'll see. So Merv calls them the soggies, the blanks, that are cleaning up the mess.
Well, what's funny is, like, at first, in the first part, they were helping with the distraction, which is what the crew was doing. Like, it was like colors and images and, you know, all kinds of stuff that would distract the dreamer, because that was supposed to keep them from gaining awareness. And then so he's like, what are you doing helping? And in this next panel, he's like, why aren't you helping? And it's like, just the, like, he's the worst. Like, he's the absolute worst. It's a very, very appropriate analog to immigration, because Merv's position is like, I mean, he literally says they're coming to take our jobs.
Yeah. I feel like the workforce analogy with the Blanks and Merv is really very on the nose. But at the same point, like, and I totally feel that. I mean, I keep feeling for Merv, though, in a way that I wasn't expecting to. Like, he's middle management in all this. He has no choice but to just, like, do what everyone says. And meanwhile, it's all failing. And, like, stuff's really bad. And no one is really addressing the problems that he's seeing, I think. And, yeah, it's really sympathetic to me, even if he's, like, shitty. Like, he's just a terrible person. But at the same point, I think he was just sort of made that way. He's an abrasive, mean character. But I don't think he's really trying to, like, hurt anybody.
I don't know about that.
I feel like Merv's hostility comes from his status and his own kind of helplessness in this, which I think is very poignant. He's always abrasive, but he's always been kind of a team player, you know? He's never been an adversary, as far as I know.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not sure if things... I think the main thing here is that things are changing a lot.
Yeah.
And I don't think he's ever had to deal with that.
Yeah, he didn't know how to deal with that. And he's in the middle of it.
Yeah.
He's ground zero.
Even though people are doing things, like, that's the thing. It's like, oh, nobody's doing anything. It's like, no, people are doing things. You just might not... Mm-hmm. Agree with them.
He's just in a position where he has no knowledge or ability to really enact positive change. And he doesn't see it getting better. So he's freaking out.
I mean, I think that's a reactionary political stance to take as well, which is, things are changing, things are scary, I don't understand, so I'm going to lash out.
Exactly. Oh, Merv, the Blanks whip the dreamer with squirrels on whips?
Well, I think it's distracting. You know, like, you have, like, a cat toy. Like,
oh, yeah.
The squirrels at the end. And I think that's such a great reference to Up. Oh, squirrels.
Squirrels. Yeah, you're right. She's totally the dog. Squirrels. Yeah. So they, like, wave these squirrels around in front of her, and she's distracted enough to stop attacking. So Merv comes at Dora, who is stealing from him. He wrecking balled her, and he grabs her by the feathered ears. In this way that is, like, ouch. And just so patriarchal, you know? It's unclear what he's really trying to do other than just, like, rein her in.
And assert his own authority.
Yeah. But, you know, to be fair, she's fucking with him. And, you know, she's outside of... Her status in the dreaming is kind of maddening. Like... She's this chaotic, powerful person that seems...
I see this as, like, he doesn't understand. He doesn't know who she is. He thinks he knows who she is. And, you know, because of that, because she's outside the structure, he thinks that she's less than somehow. And luckily, she gives him a pretty great lesson.
Yeah. Yeah. But at the same point, like, I don't know. She was stealing from his stuff. Like, I feel like she's been this... character who doesn't actually respect anybody in the dreaming, and the fact that, you know, that she's doing, she has free reign sort of in this chaotic way. I'm feeling for Merv again. Like, he didn't really
deserve
that.
Am absolutely not.
yeah
so
she totally knocks the piss out of him and throws him, like, a mile away.
And the interesting thing is, like, when she like monsters out again, and when she grabs his head, she says that he tastes like rot and silence and insignificance. And that's, I don't know, I thought that was where his face started rotting, but looking back at the other panels, he already has the rot and the flies.
Yeah, but she's picking up on it. She's the only one who's acknowledged the fact that he's, like, rotted. Yeah, and feels insignificant. Yeah.
Yep.
That sucks. So she chucks him a mile away, and he lands sort of at the foot of Eve's cave, and she picks him up. And also in his fist are feathers from her ear that that he yanked off when she chucked him. So that seems important too. Eve picks him up, brings him to her cave. She kind of listens to Merv gripe for a while. He's, you know, just kind of calling out what he's seeing with Lucien doing stuff he doesn't understand, and the new foreign elements that are causing chaos throughout the dreaming. Yeah, and he sees Lucien as a man in an ivory castle that is, you know, dictating what's happening below, about what's really going on or what people are dealing with. And then Eve tells him to kind of just shut up.
Eve tells him to do his job.
Yeah. And she's like patching up the wyvern who got injured by Balaam last time.
Yeah.
So I'm glad the wyvern's okay.
Yeah.
Definitely still got arms, but he's looking all right.
So because Merv didn't get the answer he wanted, and because obviously because Eve was a woman, she was going to side with Dora.
Yeah, that was so maddening.
Then he goes off to, he's like, well, I'll go get like a real authoritative position, and goes to talk to Cain and Abel.
Yeah.
Who are checking out the cubist structure that's in this hole in the dreaming.
Yeah, so he's trying to find some sort of ally in this wrestling match that he's in with Lucien, seeing who he knows who could be on his side.
He's stirring some shit, man. Like, he's stirring some shit.
He's trying to start shit. Well, he's completely powerless. He is in the middle of all this, and he has nobody on his side who's looking at all the shit that he's doing and all of the stuff that is going on, and no one's with him on it. And he keeps just being kicked out of stuff and told what to do, and I don't know. I feel it. No one's assessing Merv well in this. Like, it wouldn't take a lot for someone to be like, let me listen to you for a little while, and let's work together on this and make something better and make this work. Because, like, I don't know. I'm a problem solver. And when I see Merv, I'm like, okay, this guy, he's flawed. He has these problems. He's abrasive. But the stuff he's facing isn't fake. You know, he's not making up his own problems the same way that a real crazy character would be. Like, he's not crazy. He's just really flawed.
You know, he's seeing problems where there are not problems. You know, like, the idea of the Soggies is, like, they're a problem. And it's like, well, actually, maybe something else is the problem. And mm-hmm. you're just honing in on that. And you're not paying attention to other things that may need help because you have fixated on this as a problem.
He's doing what he was told and is, like, giving them jobs and, like, keeping them around. And he's not, like...
He's not doing that happily or even willingly. Like, when they come to show up to work, he's like, don't work here. You know, what are you doing?
Yeah, he doesn't get it.
See, this is where I'm like, he has come out of being a team player. And I think that's out of fear.
Yeah, well, he's just terrified. Nothing makes sense to him anymore. He's not being given access to any levers of power. He's been a positive contributor to the Dreaming for 400 years. And he sees everything changing and no one's really with him on it. But at the same point, like, he's just wrong. I feel like no one's empathizing with him. That's the issue. Like, no one's empathizing with Merv. And a little bit would help. Like if people were acknowledging and maybe, like, helping him manage the situation on his end, he would be better. We'll see where it goes, but that's just how I'm feeling it. Even though he's a dick still.
Yeah.
You know,
there may be, obviously there's not a lot we're not seeing, but I don't know. I see him as, he's a problem. He's sort of demanding things that no one else is demanding. Eve is doing her thing, you know. Cain and Abel are doing their scientific experiments.
Yeah.
where Cain throws Abel into the crevasse. He's like, oh, it goes on for miles. You know, sure. Okay. Like, we're figuring that out. And, you know, somebody's got to do it, I guess.
Yeah. And they're not, like, listening to Merv at all when he goes to try and talk to them. Yeah. I feel like we're not going to figure out Merv just yet. Merv's on a journey. I'm eager to see how Merv comes out of this. Because I feel like Merv is being like the shitty conservative racist uncle or something, you know, like, he's analogous for that sort of thinking in our current world where, like, people see themselves as underserved. And then because of that, they don't see a bigger picture. And the fact that they're underserved is not invalid. It's true. Someone might be underserved by their station, but it doesn't excuse their behavior.
Yeah, I think this whole thing is colored by, for me, about what happens at the very end.
But let's talk about Cain and Abel for a second, because like they're hanging out by the giant cubes that have popped up in the dreaming by the underneath the giant crack in the sky. So these big bright white featureless pixel boxes, and so they're sort of touching them. I can't tell if they're not really touching them.
No, not yet.
And then Cain sort of flips Abel up over them and into the giant chasm beneath. And as Abel falls into it, it looks like he's falling into the cubes. It almost looks like he's being sliced apart by them, but I think that's just an effect.
I see it as Cain, like, flipped him up, and there's the chasm between where they're standing and where the thing is floating. He's flipping him up, and then he falls in front of the structure.
There's, like, a funny bit of coloring, though, like...
Oh, I see what you mean.
Yeah, like...
I missed that.
Yeah, so as Cain flips Abel up into the air, Abel flies into the cubes.
Yeah.
It looks like he's sort of phasing into the cubes, and around that area where his body's going into them, it's bright red, as if he's being sliced open by the lines of the geometry.
Yeah.
And so that's kind of alarming. But then he sort of just climbs out of the chasm and seems fine. Abel is being hoisted out of the giant chasm by Cain on a rope. And he's like, How did it feel? Did you commune with a dark and eldritch presence? Wondering what the heck is down there in this chasm. And Abel's just like...
You in very much pain.
Yeah. And like, Abel's like, there was nothing down there. It was misty. It was nothing.
Well, but that's the thing. It's like the look on his face to me looks like there was nothing.
Something else.
Like, he's shocked that there's nothing.
Yeah. And he says, I don't feel the slightest bit different. And then, but then there's the line that directly follows it is Merv saying, everything's infected and nobody seems to notice. And I feel like there's something that happened to Abel down there. Like, that seems significant to me.
Abel could
be exposed to this.
One really important thing that happens right before Cain flips Abel into the chasm is he's about to tell a secret about Dora. And the only thing that he gets out is that she's and it's something that starts with the letter H.
Yeah, she's actually a ha-ha.
Yep.
So what do you think? Do you think she's a harpy?
I'm not making any, nope, no idea. I'm just letting that little crossword puzzle hint hang around.
I mean, I think for me, the obvious guess would be harpy, that she's some kind of harpy, because she's kind of feathered and she's angry and powerful. I feel like harpies speak their mind, but I don't really know what a harpy means in the game in verse.
Yeah,
you know what that could really mean. I don't think we've seen harpies before that I can think of.
You know, I would be shocked if they weren't in the earlier ones.
Yeah, they seem kind of square one for mythology.
Yeah,
but who knows? So Abel knows what Dora is. Lots of people seem to sort of know what Dora is, but only like be able to say so in their own ways that don't really give us a lot of answers.
Or maybe he calls it a secret, so maybe there's a reason why her true nature isn't known.
Sure, we'll find out eventually.
So Marv stalks off and does a really quick detour at Rizzulli's boat mansion.
Yeah, like he's just walking around, and he's like, what the heck? There's a giant boat here.
Yep.
Which is awesome. I wasn't expecting that either. It made me super happy to turn this page. And it's a gorgeous page where the gutters are drawn as leaves and vines.
Yep.
It's raining and the trees that are growing around the boat are droopy and mossy. And he's alarmed that this giant thing has landed in the dreaming and no one has consulted him. And no one is like, you know, he's the caretaker. And he's like, what the heck? Nobody called me.
And he's basically saying, like, you can't park this here. and she's like, I'd like to see you try.
Yeah, like, why didn't anybody stop you? And suddenly we see Rizzulli, I guess, she's out on the bow of the ship having a smoke.
Yep.
And she's like, what makes you think you could stop?
Of course, how he would take it affronts him even more.
Yeah, I get it. But her statement is funny. What makes you think that you could stop me from being here? But like, her being there didn't seem to be really of her. I feel like this sort of doesn't jive with what we saw in the beginning of House of Whispers, where the boat was brought into the dreaming sort of as this chaotic accident. But maybe it did have to do with her. Maybe Rizzulli had a hand in bringing it there.
I mean, I think her statement is more like putting him in his place.
Yeah.
Like, he's saying, you can't just do that. And she's like, there's nothing that could have happened to stop this. whatever powers are at play over here, they're nothing compared to mine.
Yeah.
He's like, there's no boats here. And she's like, and here, but here it seems to be.
Mm-hmm.
And she's figuring stuff out, I think, is what she's doing with her smoke out on the deck.
Yeah, she's smoking a big old cigar, and the smoke coming off of it forms a little skull as it wafts away.
Oh, so cool. Yeah,
it's so good. The art is, this comic is, the art is fantastic.
Drop dead gorgeous. Yeah.
So, and this is sort of the straw that I think kind of breaks Merv a little bit. He like goes back to Lucien.
Yeah.
He's just like, this isn't supposed to happen here. Like, what the heck? A whole new story house plopped into the dreaming. Nobody tells me. And he goes to Lucien, and Lucien is in the process of uncreating Merv's entire crew. Like all the little gnomes and goblins and people that are always part of his crew that help him build everything and manage all the stuff. Lucien's like, we gotta repurpose these people. Don't worry, they're totally fine with it. But you've got all the blanks now. You've got all these workers that are totally fine and they'll help you. So there you go. I don't know. That really sucks. I don't know. I feel it. I feel like Merv is being pushed in this direction that like nobody should be treating someone like that. And Lucien, like as much as I'm sympathetic to Lucien too, I feel like they're both doing this really wrong. They should be working together.
Well, I think that, I mean, especially Lucien, I think he's doing the best he can if he hasn't been corrupted somehow, which is what Merv talks about. But that to me sounds like just loony conspiracy theory kind of stuff, where he's like, it goes all the way to the top and like everything's rotten. So he tails Dora and Ziggy and they meet up with Matthew, who's sort of working as a diplomat with Dora.
Matthew is perched on a tree and Dora walks up and he gets her attention and he says that he basically says that Merv's crew was dissolved as sort of a personal favor to Dora because they were giving her a hard time. And that's like, and you see Merv's face is like super sad. He's sad about all his friends.
Yeah.
Like it's fucking cruel. Like that's like, I don't know. It really doesn't sit well with me.
I mean, he's saying it also had to happen, but we decided maybe this would be helpful to you.
But it was still a choice. Acting as if it wouldn't affect Merv, who is, you know, your high level manager. And when you dissolve his crew, that's super shitty. In this scene, they want to know how Dora does what she does. They see her as powerful and want to see if they can utilize her for help.
To find Daniel.
And she's like, I actually know what's going on here. Dream's gone. You're covering for it. You're not talking about it, but I can tell. Dream's gone.
Yeah.
And she does it in this terrifying way and like squeezes Matthew and is not committing to help at all, but confronting him with this truth and being like, I know what's going on. Don't front that this is some other kind of favor. But meanwhile, Merv, who had followed her out there, hears this. And he didn't know the dream was gone. And he's
right.
Sunken and heartbroken. Like he's just flops down into a bush and is just like super sad looking. And so that's kind of the breaking point. It all kind of led to this.
Well, and then not only that, but like the panel where he's devastated finding out that Dream really is gone, he's also talking about the fact that the Soggies, as he called them, actually did what they were supposed to do, did a good job. And the dreamer that was sort of threatening the dreaming, he says, either woke up or died. And so whatever cascade was happening stopped.
Yeah.
And so he's pretty salty about the fact that other people can do the job that he was managing.
Yeah, he's obsolete too.
He's becoming obsolete.
Yeah, it sucks. He goes to talk to Lucien, but he actually doesn't talk to him. He like looks in on him and he sees Lucien kind of sulking with a candle.
Well, Lucien seems like he's losing some power maybe because he's trying to say once upon a time there was, and he keeps losing the words as he's staring at this candle. You know, Lucien is losing some of his power too.
Yeah, and it's interesting. Like, there's something Merv mentions earlier when talking about Lucien that I really liked. He's talking about Lucien to the unnamed figure, and he talks about Lucien's origin. In the scene where Lucien is stuffing the cuckoo into the black chest, Merv says, "You remember the librarian, don't you? Of course you do, cocky little dweeb. Say, did you know he started as a decent working class story narrator? Same as you. Am I right?"
Yeah.
So, like, I really like that line. It shows that, like, Merv has, like, a respect for what Lucien's origins are. And that Lucien was once a working class storyteller. And the fact that this working class storyteller looks at the working class of the dream and just sees like resources that they can dissolve. I find that very poignant.
I see that, and I also see that Merv is jealous that he has not progressed to the level that Lucien has.
Yeah, his station has remained the same.
Mostly because
years.
He doesn't have those skills. Yeah. Like, he doesn't have the skills that would be required to do the job that Lucien does.
Yeah. I don't know. I hope at the end of all this, Merv gets a promotion of some kind. Or, like, gets to be something new.
I want him to go back to Pumpkin Patch, personally.
Maybe.
I think it's
one or the other.
I think Merv has outlived his usefulness.
Maybe.
Especially because, okay, we have to talk about what happened.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, so.
Like, what a dumb shit move Merv pulls.
So he pokes in on Lucien and he sees Lucien moping, and Lucien is saying once upon a time and stuttering and can't seem to tell a story. So I think that's important too. Yep. Like, Lucien, who was once a working class storyteller, can no longer tell a story even to himself when he's sitting alone. And I think that's kind of interesting. He's sitting there and there's a key next to him. And then the next time we see Merv has got this key. So, like, basically he snuck it in. Yoinked the key to the black chest. This unseen figure with a gun.
And we find out who it is.
Merv is looking for someone with a strong hand. Someone who will help take charge of the dreaming. Who will put things right again.
That's what he looks for. Like, that's what he thinks is the solution.
Yeah. He wants someone powerful at the top.
Yeah, but, like, what kind of power is he looking at?
I know.
I mean, like, can we just say who it is now?
Yeah, so we turn the page, and we see... Dun, dun, dun.
Judge Gallows.
Judge Gallows.
Who is this epitome of this white, Western, you know, the hanging judge, which is exactly what Judge Gallows is.
Yeah, he's a venerable old white man in an imposing cloak with a big gun and a gavel with a skull on it. He's just instantly scary. And he's an old-school DC character that hasn't really been seen very often. He's only been in a few comics, but there was an issue of The Dreaming where he appeared years ago.
In 1996.
In The Dreaming Special Edition number 1, which I had not even read until recently.
Shout out to John Jameson for giving us that reference.
Yeah, I couldn't tell if he was new, and I was going to Google him, and then John quickly was like, no, he showed up here.
And in the special, just to quickly recap that, Abel conjures him or releases him from the box, the kind of Pandora's box, and he brings him out because he wants to put Cain, his brother, on trial for constantly murdering him.
Yeah.
And then it turns out through all of that, it's a really great issue, sort of going through the whole, everybody in the Dreaming is not a fan of Cain.
Yeah, so it turns into this whole Dreaming-wide kind of trial of Cain. Where, you know, everyone talks about all the times they've seen him murder his brother over and over again.
Yep, or just what a douche he is.
Yeah, and it sort of calls into, like, the question of, like, well, if is it really murder if the guy just keeps coming back?
Right.
Sort of.
Oh my god, and the Corinthian is there.
Yeah, everybody sort of makes an appearance.
Who was it who was saying, oh, and then Cain tells Matthew, who's his attorney, and in that, Merv is the prosecutor, which maybe there's some, you know.
Yeah.
Thing to be said for that as well.
Yeah.
He tells Matthew, he's like, put me on the stand. And he's like, that's a terrible idea. So he's like, just do it. And so he goes up there and he almost murders Abel, like, from the stand. Which is like,
just because he can't help
not
it.
Not helping the case.
Yeah, it just sort of was what he does.
It's what he does, yeah. So because he can't be killed, because he has the mark of Cain, and any injury to him comes back sevenfold. Because he has that, the judge can't kill him, but he banishes him to the waking world. And while Cain is there, the waking world starts going to shit.
Yeah.
Because, again, it's about balance. The balance is off because half of the original sin of the original murder is apart from the other half. Abel's in the dreaming and Cain is in the waking world. Yeah. And when that happens, there's no catharsis for the violent tendencies of mankind while Cain is away.
Yeah, so people in the waking world start murdering one another in these terrible ways that are, they're often like murdering the ones you love, like murdering family or committing these heinous crimes that just are almost senseless.
Yeah, completely senseless.
Because in the dreaming, people aren't able to kind of work through their subconscious murderous anger at those closest to them.
The murder, like the constant perpetual murder that Cain does to Abel, it's the story that has to be told over and over again. The story that is told over and over again. And through its telling, it's the release.
Yeah, it keeps people from doing the same thing. So yeah. It was a pretty cool story. And really, like, I really liked that window into the nature of Cain and Abel. They're often characters in the dream. I'm like, why are they even there, really? Like, it doesn't make a lot of sense. And they don't really match anybody.
It's so sweet because Abel is like, I miss Cain. I want him to come back.
I know.
Like, I just wanted him to not murder me so much.
Yeah, he just wanted a break. He just wanted a break from it for, like, a week to, like, not get murdered.
It's so sweet because then he goes back. He's like, all right, we got to get you back. You know, things are out of balance. And what ends up happening is Judge Gallows is like, oh, he's such the epitome of the legal system. Completely inflexible. And says, no ruling of mine will be overturned. And I've never reversed a ruling. And what ends up happening is he strikes Cain. And Cain's like, oh, you did it now? Yeah. I think if I read the panel right, he ends up being smashed by a Pakistani taxi driver who has gone on a murderous rampage. And then he also sort of like cracks into like lightning somehow.
So he's done away with in a great move of justice as he tries to lash out at Cain. And it comes back at him.
Yeah.
But when anyone else tried to challenge him, there was a whole sequence after Cain was banished. People came back to the judge and were like, you know, Abel came back to him and was like, you know, I feel bad. I didn't really want him gone forever.
Right.
And Judge Gallows was just like, I don't reverse my decisions. I'm a murderous fascist who will lay down the law and you will take it. And he was terrifying.
He doesn't care about justice. He just cares about his ruling.
Yeah, he's awful. He's a terrifying, awful character.
Which is so, my God, right now. Oh, my God.
I know.
Talking about horrible fucking judges.
Yeah, it's like kind of too much almost.
I can't. Like, it's kind of too much.
Yeah, I was like, really? This week? This comic this week?
Yeah, this comic this week.
So Judge Gallows, he's been brought back, and he's gonna lay down the law in the dreaming somehow.
It's gonna be bad. It's bad. There is nothing good that can come of this.
Well, I don't know. I'm hopeful that he changes the status quo for an issue or two as a bad guy, but he's not the big bad. You know, he's like he's trouble, and Merv just brought some trouble.
I mean, he's not gonna be any match for Urzuli. Like, I'm not worried about that.
Like, it'll be interesting to see. Like his power. Like, what the heck is it, and where does it come from? You know, like, these characters in the dreaming, they are powerful, but only in these ways that we don't really know what their power comes from. Is it like power from sort of a collective unconscious or something, or who knows? So, like, I don't know. Is he more powerful than Urzuli? He seemed to sort of have the power to lay down the law in the dreaming as he saw fit.
Yeah.
He's fundamentally disturbing. As much as I'm eager to see what they do with this story, I hope we don't get 6 months of Judge Gallows, or like have him become like somehow like the new status quo and maybe not totally bad, so everyone kind of accepts it for a while. I really don't want the dreaming to fall under the rule of this character for any length of time because he's so upsetting and disturbing, but you know, we'll see what happens. It'll be interesting to see what he comes up against, what people in the dreaming are able to do.
I think we should wrap up.
What notes do we end on here? Like, this, there's a lot of crazy stuff that happened in this episode. It was like major things happened to everybody.
Not an end with a note of hope?
Yeah.
No.
Yeah, I think things are going to get crazier in the dreaming. I'm heartened by, like, the characters in the dreaming finding techniques that deal with the craziness around them a little bit. They're starting to manage.
We are looking for solutions. You know, like, I really do think that other people are looking for solutions other than Merv.
Yeah.
I'm actually, now that I think about it, I'm really excited to see what happens with Cain and Abel seeing Judge Gallows again.
Yeah, me too.
Because they could be a big weapon against him.
Yeah, but also, like, they seemed sort of powerless until he tried to strike Cain.
Right.
Judge Gallows seems very powerful. I don't know, again, like, the Corinthian is super powerful, but, like, he's not going to take over the dreaming. It's a world where these rules don't necessarily add up neatly to so-and-so is stronger than so-and-so.
Comic books, so you know
it is comic books. Yeah, and I think I think that just like his very presence is terrifying enough for us to understand he's powerful, and no one's really in a position to stand up against them. And actually, in the preview cover for the next issue, it has Judge Gallows holding his gavel over Cain and Abel and Goldie, who are running from him, and it describes Judge Gallows as a nightmare of the major arcana, terror of the old frontier.
He's the epitome of manifest destiny, colonialism, genocide.
Yeah, he's lawful evil.
Yeah, he sure is.
And so he's gonna be bad. It's gonna be sad. It's gonna be hard. I guess in the end, I hope that, you know, Merv wouldn't be the first kind of good character to fuck up and get help from the wrong person who he thought would be good. I feel so sympathetic to Merv because I feel like he's part of the dreaming. He's part of this whole situation. They have to figure out how to fight the problems together because they have to figure that out.
So next episode, we will be doing Lucifer number one.
Yeah.
Checking in with our favorite devil.
He looks big and woolly and hairy, and who knows what's going to happen next. He's been cast down to Earth. So much has happened since we read Sandman Universe number one.
I feel like he's been doing some walkabout through the desert. So.
Yeah. Yeah, he's on his own messianic journey, it seems. We'll check in with that fella next time.
And so until then, we will, of course, be posting some research links on our Facebook page and some images on our Instagram.
Yeah.
So our Instagram is @SandmanSalon. You can find us on Facebook, usually by searching Sandman Salon, but if you have to do the / thing, it's The Sandman Salon.
Yep, on Facebook. And we're on Twitter too, @SandmanSalon. So give us a follow and let us know what you'd like us to chat about. If you have any questions or comments, please send them our way.
See you then.
Bye-bye. If you enjoyed this podcast, please give us a follow and tell your cool friends about us so we can all hang out.